next speaker is one of our greatest comedians and actors, a python who's travelled all around the world. We're celebrating today, in fact, the 75th anniversary of his first performance in 1948, aged 5, playing Martha Cratchit in a school performance of A Christmas Carol. He's renowned as the nicest man in show business, although, as he said in an interview in the Old Day a few years ago, Maggie Smith once described me as a saint, the sort of good person who, if he went and strangled a baby in the street, people would say the baby attacked him first. Michael Palin talking about his new book, Great Uncle Harry, A Tale of War and Empire.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Bob. One word I would never associate with Barry is envy. Well, I'm going to talk this afternoon really about my book on Great Uncle Harry. Now, the book began from one photograph, and the photograph is really what is on the cover of the book, and I discovered this in a pile of archive material given to us by an aged great aunt in the 1970s. Now, when she gave us all this stuff, I didn't really look at it, because at that time I was just busy with my own present and my own future, rather than the family's past. It's odd. As you get older, suddenly the past becomes rather more interesting. But I knew that this archive material was there. And when I looked through it, one thing really struck me, and that was this photograph of a young man with a lemon squeezer hat, a military uniform, looking slightly warily at the camera. And I asked my parents at the time, I said, well, who's this? Oh, that's Uncle Harry, he died in the war. And that was it. No one could tell me anything more about it. And I became fascinated. I didn't know that the Palin family had ever any soldiers, let alone anyone who would have died for their country. So during the COVID pandemic, I decided I would try and find out as much as I could about Great Uncle Harry and try and give him some credit. I didn't know what I would find. I knew quite a bit about his parents. His father was Edward Palin. He was a don at Oxford, at St. John's College. And I had two diaries, which had also come in the family archive, of his travels in Switzerland during his holidays. To become a don then at St. John's College, you had to take a vow of celibacy. So he was officially celibate. But the diaries of his trips in Switzerland are full of references to any lady he ever sees.
Oh, never was a pretty little girl. Oh, yes.
Lovely lady, made my bath water the other night. I mean, it's strewn with ladies. It was worse than 50 Shades of Grey. But clearly he wasn't a natural celibate, that's the word. Anyway, he meets, while he's on his journey, he meets a young American girl and an older woman who was with her, and they were doing the grand tour of Europe, and he falls in love with her. And it's in the diary, he writes, you know, if only our ages had been closer, how different things might have been. He was 35 at the time, she was 17. It turned out that she, who was my great-grandmother, was an orphan from the Irish potato famines. She had been saved and gone on one of what they call the coffin ships, because they were so appallingly sort of dangerous. Gone coffin ships across the Atlantic, been adopted by a rich American lady who was a widow and who was very interested in female education and set up a college in America. She took over this girl called Brita, brought her to Europe for the grand tour. So that's how they all met. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Edward eventually gave up any attempt at celibacy and married her in 1867 in Paris, actually, as it happened. So there they were. He got thrown out of St. John's College for being uncelibate. and he was given a living at a Linton in Herefordshire. They became the vicar. And they started to have a family. And they had a very successful family. They had six children, two boys, four girls. Everything was going very, very well. And then they decided... I don't know if they decided whether it actually just was a mistake, but they had a seventh child, born 6 years after all the others, when his father was then nearing 60, his mother was 42 years old at the time, which was quite old for that period. In fact, I think it was the sort of life, that was a general sort of lifespan at that period. Anyway, they had another child, and he was called Harry, or Henry William Bourne Palin. And from the start, I could see from what I learnt from my research, was that he wasn't very successful. He wasn't particularly supported by the family. His eldest brother got a first at Christ Church, was a very successful doctor. The son was doing well at Shrewsbury School. The four girls were all very talented and helped out in the local church and all that sort of thing. And Harry was kind of left, just because he wasn't mentioned very much. It was clear that he was not someone who'd lived up to their expectations. Anyway, he goes to Shrewsbury School, as I did, and as his father and his brother did. During that time, he was there for 2 years, and he hadn't really sort of lived up to their expectations. And then he was sent off after that to India, because they wanted him just to achieve something, you know, what a middle-class family should be achieving at the time. He could go to India because some of the family were already in India. They were living in Calcutta. They got him a job with the Indian Railways as junior traffic administrator. After 4 years, he was still a junior traffic administrator, so that clearly hadn't worked out. He was then given a job on the tea plantations in India, and that hadn't worked out very well. And I know that from some very good research, because Finlays of Glasgow, who owned the tea plantations, had kind of reports on their people, their employees, and Harry doesn't come out of it very well. He starts off quite well. Palin seems only a very good chap. He seems to be working hard. Then after about 3 months, Palin doesn't seem to really have his heart in the job. And after about 6 months, Palin is just not worth his salary. So I've gotten more and more fascinated by this failure. And I must say, it wasn't all gloom, because in the research for the book, I did find one or two rather nice things, including when I was researching what he might have been brought up on in terms of books and all that, and G.A. Henty and things like that. But when he would have been at school, he'd also been brought up on the Boy's Own Paper. And the Boy's Own Paper was launched in 1879, and it was very, very widely read. And this here is a quote from the book. It was a correspondence column that gives an interesting insight, often unintentional, into the concerns and anxieties of boys of Harry's age. Spots, masturbation, and fear of weediness seem to predominate. Now, the boys, because the boys who wrote in mostly used pseudonyms, and since their letters were never actually published, their content had to be guessed at from the answers. This made for some bizarre reading. Fred L., for example, is advised, by all means, remove your moustache if you're only 5 feet high. Young taxidermist is told briskly, why not boil the rabbit, eat the meat, preserve the bones, and then prepare the skeleton? There's no better way for a beginner. Those are the frankly bizarre queries which the editor clearly has little patience. Arthur is severely reprimanded, we do not understand you. You cannot get photographs of people who lived before photography was invented. That's quite wrong. The column is haunted by the ever-present spectre of evil habits. Swallow is urged to have a cold bath every morning and wash yourself all over. An anonymous correspondent is taken to task. Are you not constantly told that such practices ruin the life of thousands? Anyway, I hope Harry had a sense of humour, otherwise school life would have been totally miserable. Anyway, later I found out that when he went to India, he would have probably had a guidebook or a phrase book, and my own father, who went to India in the 1920s, actually bequeathed to me a book called Hindustani Simplified by S.B. Syed. And this was obviously a phrase book for people going out to work in India. And though compiled by an Indian, the tone of this latter work is uncompromisingly imperial, as can be seen from a brief glance at the phrases in lesson one. Bring water, bring bread, bring dinner, come here, go there, go out, do this, write this. Like a holy lunch. In part two, sentences, there's an exercise which reads like an instruction sheet from Basil Fawlty to Manuel. Write a letter, call him here, do this for me, do not come near, open the box. Do not sit here, wait downstairs. Speak clearly, bring all the books. Burn this. Burn this. Come after dinner, don't make a noise, get down from there. By the way, you. Come here at once, speak easy, Hindustani, go away, hold your tongue, bring 3 cups of tea, sit here, wash your face, clean the table, ask him his name, put the gun there, shut the box, do not forget me, prepare dinner for 8 men, read good books, sit on the ground, mind this pen, mend this pen, sorry, don't come to me, don't laugh. I think still copies of Syed's Guide to Hindustani. Anyway, so Harry fails at school, he fails in business, he fails in India, and he decides to take his life into his own hands, and he goes off to New Zealand on an assisted passage to become a farmhand. And I think that was where he was happiest. Not what his family would have wanted, but he was happy. He met people there. A lot of other English public school boys would come to New Zealand because they were obviously fed up with being bossed around at home and told what to do and going into family business. So he was very happy there for a few years. And then in 1914, war breaks out. And immediately, all these people who fled from England because they can't stand it sign up to go and fight for the empire and go back home. And he joins up in Nelson in New Zealand, and he joins the New Zealand division. They go across the Indian Ocean back to Europe, and they all think at the time that they're going to go home. They'll have a chance to have home leave, those who've left England. And they're told that the war is going to be over in 6 months, and it's going to be fine for them to fight, they're not even going to get hurt. And this is something that I found in reading a lot of the research while I was doing on Harry's war career, is that there was a lot of propaganda. They were told what they should believe, not what was actually happening. They didn't know where they were going, they didn't really know anything about where they're going to be deployed. So they end up in Egypt. Now, the great thing about the book at this point is that I have some diaries of Harry. Again, this was an archive, a little envelope, very, very slim little notebooks, all tiny sort of pencil writing, which he kept from the day he joined up to within 2 weeks of his death in France. And these were helped, this was helped enormously by a call to Peter Jackson. Sir Peter Jackson, who did the film about the First World War and Lord of the Rings and all that sort of thing, he had great uncles in the war, and he has a huge database. And he said, if you let me have a good photo of your great uncle, and if you can let me know down to the actual platoon he was in, I will be able to find some photographs of him. And I sent them out. I sent the photographs on the front of the book. And he was amazed. He said, this is perfect. I found 2 pictures, which I'm sure are exactly your great uncle. So he found these pictures of great uncle in the trenches. And another really nice bit of research that I didn't expect to find was I found a letter from my father, who was 15 years old, and he was at school, and it was 1915. And he wrote to his parents to say that there is a magazine called The Empire of Nations in which there is a picture of the Anzac troops going ashore at Gallipoli. And he was convinced that the main figure there was Uncle Harry. And I thought, if my father, who had known Uncle Harry for 15 years, if he said that's Uncle Harry, then it's Uncle Harry. And it was also very like the 2 photos that Peter Jackson found. So I now know what Harry looked like. Anyway, to go on with the story, Harry survived 4 years, 4 months, sorry, at Gallipoli. He was one of the few who survived without a scratch. Thousands died there, a lot of them out from disease. But he got back, he was taken back to Egypt and prepared, and at last he went back home. He went to England in order to go onto the Western Front. And this was the first time he'd been home for 4 years, and is in his diary. He goes back to see his parents. His mother's living in Tunbridge, father's died, and he goes to see his girlfriend, Marge, Marjorie, who has been writing to for 3 years. And there's a lovely bit where they get together and he takes her to a show in the West End. It's on the penultimate day of his leave. And they go back in a taxi together and he pops the question, will she marry him? And she says no. And it's beautifully done. And I mean, maybe she just thought it wasn't the time. He's going off to Europe and they get killed. But then he goes back and within a few months, he's dead. So there are lots of little things there which taught me about Harry and made me feel that here was someone who may have been a drifter, but he, you know, had a real feeling. He was very, very good with people. He understood people. He corresponded with people and all that. And right to the very end, when he describes an attack, he doesn't really talk about the weapons used, the bloodshed and all that. He gives the names of all his friends who died in that attack. And that I think is very, very significant and makes it all the sadder when September the 27th, 1916, he's in one of the attackers in an assault on the big German trench, and they attack across a sort of a meadow, which I've actually seen myself, towards a small ridge where the Germans are firing at them. And there is a very poignant piece of material from the New Zealand archive in which the man who was with him in a shell hole at the time says, Palin stood up and was shot instantly through the head. Now, just very quickly, before I finish, I don't believe that, because his body was never found. He was so what happened? If he was shot through the head, he could easily have been taken back to a dressing station and survived. But he there was no sign of him. Either he was blown apart or else he was just buried in the dust and the mud of war. Anyway, that's the sad thing, that I've seen his name on a wall in a cemetery, but no one knows really where he is. But I just feel that in writing the story of Harry, I was writing a story about somebody who you know, who'd just been ignored, but was one of the vital people who were fighting for the British troops during that war. And the final thing, I thought, well, you know, he's miles away, and yet he's not. If he had lived to the age I am now, which is 80 years old, he could have been with me at my 21st party. So I feel that we're not that far apart. Thank you very much.